I grew more and more desperate to win Sue over as the summer went by. So by the last week of August, I was in a state of silent panic. That is how I'd characterize my misguided, bizarre mindset, and it's the only explanation I can find for the completely retarded stunt that I resorted to one sunny afternoon just before she left. The day started out pretty normal, as I recall. I made plans with some friends to play wiffle ball in my backyard around 1 p.m. I then spoke to Sue, who half-heartedly asked me if I wanted to come along with her while she ran errands in her mother's car, a 77 Ford Granada. Parents love a car like that because it's slow and boring and safe. They feel entirely comfortable loaning a car like that to their teenagers, because the only kind of death it will cause is dying of embarrassment. Sue had quite a few items to buy and loose ends to tie up before making her big move to college, so this run was going to take all morning. I agreed to go with her before she described the dull and tedious list of stops we'd have to make. Not that it would have made a difference to me. I was being presented with an entire morning to work my magic every which way on her. There were going to be opportunities to woo her left and right. Surely this would be the day that Sue fell forever for Artie. It didn't quite work out that way, but not for a lack of trying. From the moment she picked me up, I looked for any excuse to show off my absolutely charming sense of spontaneity. Sadly, I found no openings apart from my usual and constant busting of chops all around. And I was even coming up short in that department. I really hadn't considered just how boring a morning of pre-college errands can be. As should be apparent by now, Sue was way more mature than I was. She already had her own bank account and a checkbook, which to me was very impressive. The final errand of the morning was stopping off at the bank to deposit a check. I'd gotten nowhere in my mission, and I was very aware of the fact that this was the end of the ride, so to speak. So I decided to go into the bank with her and at the very least bust some more chops. When we got inside, Sue went to the back to do her banking while I walked around like a boob, unsuccessfully avoiding boredom. The only thing that aroused my interest was a teller in one of the front windows, a really cute broad in her mid-20s with dark hair and nice tits. I looked around, saw that Sue was occupied, and then went over to the table that held all of the different slips and picked up a pen. I was already a huge fan of Woody Allen by then, and I especially liked the film Take the Money and Run. In one of the funniest scenes in the movie, Woody's character, Virgil Starkwell, writes a stick-up note on the back of a bank deposit slip. But his handwriting is so poor that the teller can't read it. She thinks that the word gun is the word gub and reads it out loud and asks him what a gub is and blows his whole plan. If you haven't seen that movie, you should. I highly recommend it. In a misguided homage to that scene, I thought the best thing I could possibly do at that moment would be to write a fake hold-up note on the back of a deposit slip and hand it to this cute teller. Like a moron, I figured it would go down like this. I'd hand it to the girl, she would laugh, knowing right away that it was a joke. She'd probably even seen the movie. And even if she didn't, what I'd done would be so funny to her that she'd become terribly attracted to me. Sue would then see me pull this prank off, and the combination of my successful gag and the cute teller digging me would win her over instantly, and college be damned, she would be mine. In my mind, this plan was extra crazy, but it was what the situation called for. So it made complete sense. I remember the note I wrote almost word for word, mostly because the judge read it back to me about 50 times in juvenile court, as you will soon see. It went like this. I have a gun. Put $50,000 into a bag. Turn around and count to 1,000. Please act casually. Thank you for your cooperation. And I signed it, Artie Lang, Jr. I wish I was bullshitting you with this one, but I'm not. I really am that retarded. I didn't consider that this teller might freak out because probably at least once she'd worried about having a gun stuck in her face at work. No, to me the fact that I'd signed the note was indication enough to anybody that I was joking. Brilliant! Assured that I had finally come up with the grand slam of gags, I walked up to the window and handed the girl my note. I then slammed into a brick wall called reality. My signature, as the foolproof indication that this was a joke, meant shit to her. The first thing that this girl read was, I have a gun, and it was over. She turned white as a ghost, started shaking, and looked like she was about to start sobbing. I immediately panicked and grabbed the note out of her hand. It's a joke, I said, trying to keep my voice down. Really, it was a joke. It's just a joke. I am so, so sorry. The teller took a deep breath and looked relieved and started to calm down a bit. It seemed like she believed me. About this time, I saw Sue coming my way. I am really sorry, I said, trying to smile benevolently. I was just trying to make you laugh. I wasn't serious at all, I promise. Then I got away from her window as fast as I could. I crumpled up the note, threw it into the nearest trash can, and walked over to Sue. That was another sign that I'm both retarded and not cut out for a life of crime. I stupidly left behind the piece of evidence that would come back to bite me in the ass. Sue knew nothing at all about what had happened, and I chose not to tell her, thinking as we got back into her mother's car that I dodged a bullet. Sue drove me home to my wiffle ball game and told me she was heading to Mandy's on Route 22 to shop for clothes for college. Great, I said. I'll call you later. I headed into the backyard and played wiffle ball with my buddies Deed, Shecky, Larry, and Kevin. Those guys are not relevant to the story in any way whatsoever, but I promised them that I'd put their names in my audiobook. So now that I've done that, we can move on. As my friends and I ascended into wiffle ball heaven, the real drama was unfolding elsewhere. Back at the bank, the teller might have managed a half a smile and acted like it was okay at the end of our ordeal, but she failed to mention that during her initial panic, she remembered enough of her training video to trigger the silent alarm that went straight to the local police station. 30 seconds after Sue and I walked out of the bank and drove away, a mini SWAT team pulled up to the back entrance prepared to handle an armed bank robbery in progress. When they didn't find one, the teller explained what had happened. But if there's one group of people that sure as hell wasn't going to see the humor in a shitheaded prank like that, it's a SWAT team. I have no idea how convincing the teller was in upholding my innocence, but it wouldn't have mattered if she were as earnest as Sally Field accepting her Oscar. There was no keeping those cops from arresting me. It really was my lucky day, because not only was I, Artie Lang Jr., officially the jerk-off who'd left sign evidence of his misguided practical joke right there in the bank, I had also messed with a teller who'd managed to write down the license plate number of Sue's mom's car as we drove away. It says nothing of that broad's grace under pressure. Sue's mom's Granada had as much pickup as a covered wagon, so if she wanted to, the girl could have cried for a few minutes, then sharpened a pencil, walked around the desk and outside to the sidewalk, put on her glasses, and written down the plate number before we were out of visual range. It was some getaway car, let me tell you. The thing is, even if she hadn't written that down, it wasn't going to take Sherlock Holmes to find us, considering that the bank had Sue's home address. I guess that it took the SWAT team 30 minutes or less to figure all of this out. Drive to Sue's house and surround the place like it was Waco. Her parents, thank God, were at work, but her sister Teresa was not. Now, I love Teresa. I really did. But there's one thing that I have to say about her. To this day, she is the loudest broad I have ever met. Normal people have what you'd call a speaking voice, a whisper, and a yell. Now think of the average person you know yelling your name across a crowded party at a sports event, or just before you're about to step in front of an oncoming bus. Teresa's whisper was as loud as that. She could carry on a conversation comfortably over the sound of a jet engine. That afternoon, the cops stormed into Sue's house and found Teresa, who was pretty high-strung and probably screamed and had a panic attack as they explained to her that they were looking for Sue, her mother's Ford Granada, and an unidentified male her sister had been seen with. All three were wanted in connection with an attempted bank robbery. In a frenzy, Teresa called my house, and I answered the phone on an extension that we had in our garage. I wasn't at all happy about it either, because I was in the middle of a nothing-nothing wiffle ball game that was heading into the 11th inning. It was a classic wiffle ball pitcher's duel. "Yeah, hello," I said. The moment she heard my voice, Teresa unloaded a primal yell that pierced my skull. It was so loud that all of my friends heard it and got quiet. "Artie!" she shouted. "The cops are here looking for Sue! What the fuck did you get her into? Whatever it is, I know it's your fault! What is it, Artie? Is it drugs? If Sue gets arrested and cannot go to college, I will not be able to move into her bedroom, and I will never fucking forgive you. I know it's fucking drugs." I had no idea what was going on, and there was no way I was getting a word in edgewise. It wouldn't have mattered. I did not possess what it was going to take to calm Teresa down. But I tried anyway. And then it hit me. The teller must have called the cops. But the cops didn't have Sue yet, so I thought that if I found her first, there was a chance I could turn this around somehow. I told Teresa not to worry, though I doubt she heard me over the sound of her own screaming. I hung up, borrowed my buddy Deej's blue 1980 Camaro, and raced to Mandy's on Route 22. I found Sue in the dressing room trying on a shitty mid-80s $14 blouse, the likes of which you'd find on an extra in a Bangles video. She was surprised to see me, but not surprised by the story. When I told her the whole thing, she just started laughing. She knew she hadn't done anything, and that I was the one in trouble, so there was no need to make a huge deal of it. She was a really cool chick. We did, however, have to deal with the cops, so on the advice of my buddy's uncle, who was a lawyer, we called the police station and revealed ourselves as the teenage Bonnie and Clyde they were hunting for. They told us to come down to the station to surrender ourselves, which we did. Sue was so upbeat about the whole situation that I started to think maybe this plan hadn't backfired after all. Maybe I'd actually done it. Maybe I'd finally managed the grand gesture that was bold and funny enough to win her heart. Sue laughed all the way to the station and all the way inside until they handcuffed us together. Then her carefree attitude about it changed to terror. "Artie, why are we handcuffed?" she said. "I didn't do anything. What's going to happen to us? Why am I in handcuffs?" "I don't know," I said. "Why are you asking me? I have no idea what the fuck is going to happen." It really didn't help any to say that to Sue. The cops left us cuffed to each other for an hour, just sitting in the station. Then they separated us for our individual interviews. I don't know how Sue held up, but when I got into the detective's office, I just lost it. Sue's father was a greenhorn, right off the boat from Italy. He owned a barber shop, but you never know, in Jersey. He could have been a connected guy, brought over for God knows what. On top of that, her old man did not like me one bit. There was no way I wanted to answer to his wrath should his daughter get charged with a crime. Whenever I saw her father, I'd say, "Hey, Mr. Bacardi." He'd look at me like he just smelled dog shit and grunt. Clearly, he did not want me around. During my interrogation, I begged the detectives to throw the book at me, just as long as they let Sue go. I told them the whole stupid story. I told them that it was a joke, I told them about the Woody Allen movie, and I told them that I had been doing nothing but trying to flirt with the teller girl. They said they'd need to think about what to do with us, both of us, because this was a very serious matter. What seemed like a joke to me was nothing to joke about, they said. Then they continued to scare the shit out of us for a few more hours before eventually freeing Sue with no charges and knocking mine down to a disorderly conduct charge. I was assigned a court date in November, just 3 months away. We'd driven to the police station in my friend's car, so I drove Sue home and saw my worst nightmare standing there waiting for me, her father. Teresa had told him the whole story, but he wanted to hear it from us. Oddly, he seemed okay with the whole thing after we explained it firsthand, probably because Sue wasn't in trouble in any way. Those few minutes explaining the story were terribly awkward and uncomfortable, and when they were over, I thought I was off the hook. I turned to leave, but Sue's dad stopped me. He wanted to talk to me alone. Mr. Bacardi led me into one of those family rooms that Italian families have but never use. And like most of them, this one had vinyl covers on all of the furniture. That room exuded the same kind of stillness as the entrance of a funeral parlor, and all I could think of were the scenes from mob movies where the unsuspecting Goodfellow walks into a room and gets whacked. I had no idea what Mr. Bacardi was going to say. I just knew that I'd rather have my appendix removed with a butter knife than sit through it. It wasn't going to be good, because the guy had a look of pure anger and disgust on his face. He looked at me like Mike Tyson looked at Trevor Burbick during their weigh-in that year, and we all know how that little get-together turned out. Mr. Bacardi didn't sit down, and he didn't offer me a seat. He just stood there in front of a vinyl-covered couch, and in heavily accented English said, "I want to tell you something. Mr. Bacardi, sir, you know, I'm very..." "Shh," he said, staring through me with that evil eye. "You listen to me, eh?" He pointed a finger at me. "I'll tell you one thing," I say to you. "When you rob a bank, you no take my daughter." "Sir," I said, "I wasn't robbing a bank. It was only..." He cut me off again, waving his finger and saying, No. You don't say nothing. I know you. You are crass. Do you hear me? You are crass. Just no thank of my daughter when you rob a bank. I saw no way out other than agreeing with him. Yes, sir, I will never take your daughter with me when I rob a bank, I said. And I will take all the blame from the cops for this. No one will ever know that she was even with me. For the briefest of moments, he looked satisfied, and then he grunted in my general direction. Get out, he said. When I got home, my parents had just come back from the Jersey Shore, so I told them the story. Carefully. It didn't matter. My mother went absolutely ballistic. My old man was pissed, too. But he wasn't pissed that I had done it. He was just pissed at me for getting caught. I found myself a lawyer on the recommendation of a family friend, and that was the end of that. I had to wait for the November court date, but the best part of the story was yet to come. 2 days later, in the local paper, the Union Leader, there was a story about the whole thing. Right there on the front page. The headline read, Bank Hold Up. It was only a joke. The story was there just as it happened. Because I was 17 and still a minor, legally they couldn't print my name. Sue, on the other hand, was already 18, so they could print hers. And print it they did. Driving the alleged getaway car was the man's girlfriend, Sue Picardi. As I read that, my only thought was that Sue's father was going to gut me like a fish. Thank God Sue found the whole thing so hilarious. She told her dad that it was all in good fun and that he shouldn't fuck with me. Call me crazy, but I took that as a sign that I'd finally impressed her. In the end, it didn't change the state of affairs between us much, and it definitely came too late. A week later, Sue went to college in South Jersey. As of on cue, I tried to keep it going for a while, but as she had informed me all those times that I chose to ignore, Sue had plans for her life. I had plans for mine too, but they were very, very different. I was a dreamer. I wanted to go to New York City every night to try to be a comedian. I never wanted to go to college. I wanted to start living life and to learn as I went. In my eyes, I'd try to make it in New York City, but even if I failed, the experience itself would be interesting, and any success I might find along the way would allow me to travel and see the world a bit. I saw our town the way Bruce said it in Thunder Road. It was a town full of losers, and I was pulling out of there to win. Sue's plan was much more conservative. She wanted to go to college, major in marketing, meet a guy there, marry him young, and have kids. And basically, that's exactly what happened. About 3 weeks into her first year in college, Sue met the guy she'd marry 6 years later. They had kids and bought a home close to where she grew up. And that is her life. I still see Sue every once in a while. She has adorable kids, and she seems happy, and that makes me really happy. One thing's for sure, she dodged a huge bullet by dumping my ass. I wanted my life to be interesting and different, but little did I know just how soon that would happen. As I said, my father's accident, which occurred just 2 months after Sue left, changed everything for us. It was our family's Armageddon and the start of a long, dark, winding road of self-discovery for me. I neither experienced nor pursued anything even remotely close to the orderly, stable future that Sue had planned for herself. High school crushes and dreams of making it in showbiz hit the back burner for a good long while. By the time my father died, my journey had led me to become nothing but a broke 22-year-old drunk with a gambling problem and very little future at all. As for the end of the bank story, however, here it is, and it's pretty good. By the time my November court date came around, my father had just fallen, and he was lying in the hospital paralyzed, which made my having to answer for my idiot behavior in public about a month later all the more depressing. I stood in front of the judge at Union County Courthouse in Elizabeth, New Jersey, with my lawyer at my side and my grandfather, the great Sal Caprio, lending moral support. The judge, to put it mildly, skewered me alive. Since I'd been stupid enough to throw the note away in the bank trash can, the cops were able to retrieve it. In front of an entire courtroom full of juvenile delinquents who'd done much more legitimately tough and illegal things, the judge made an example of me by yelling at the top of his lungs. "Mr. Lang," he bellowed, "let me read something to you. I have a gun. Put $50,000 into a bag." I think he truly enjoyed the note, because he must have read it 50 times in the 20 minutes it took to sentence me. Then he called me a moron. Without any kind of warning or any kind of reason, just like that, he said, Mr. Lang, you are a moron. Nothing more, nothing less. I was a moron. That was his verdict. What a wonderful morning that was. I was sentenced to 25 hours of community service and assigned to clean up all the garbage on the front lawn of the courthouse there in Elizabeth. But my first day of community service couldn't have been better. It was St. Patrick's Day, 1986. I was ordered to report to the head janitor, who would be my boss for the duration of my term. When I found him, he and his fellow workers were still so drunk from the parade that they marked me down for 10 hours of service after I'd worked only 2. That was a nice mistake. Thanks to that, it took me only 4 more days to work off my debt to society. But even in service to my community, I could not escape the ball-busting idiocy that has made me the man I am today. You see, back then and to this day, I had the kind of friends, and now the kind of job, where merciless ball-busting is expected. That's just what we do. It didn't matter that I just had my ass handed to me by a judge, or that my family was reeling from a tragedy. While I was cleaning up that front lawn, my jerk-off friends saw a golden opportunity and drove by whenever I was there to throw White Castle bags, used napkins, and whatever other shit they found in their cars out the window at me. They would then slow down and pull over to get a great view of me cleaning it up. My friends are a fun bunch of guys. They really are. Next time something bad happens to you, I'll be sure to send them over to cheer you up. The funny thing is, the judge could have yelled at me all day and made no impression on me at all, other than hammering home what my dad had tried to teach me. If you're gonna fuck around, you'd better not get caught. It took my own kind to deliver the message, and they had to do it with bags of greasy old fast food. Cleaning up their crap while they watched did it, all right, as only mocking from your peers can. I heard the message loud and clear as they laughed at me from the curb. Could I be a bigger shithead? Brazilian Deluxe. When a bunch of guys get together regularly at a bar or wherever, they eventually get around to talking about their first time. It's inevitable. The Stern Show is a good example because aside from Robin, it is definitely a bunch of guys who get together regularly, and as any listener can tell you, the subject certainly comes up from time to time. On the show, Gary and Benji have actually brought in the girls that they lost their virginity to, and Howard has asked them in cringeworthy detail every single fact surrounding the big event. When the question came my way, I just sort of brushed it aside. It wasn't tough to do. I had done the same thing with my buddy since forever. Whenever the conversation came around, I'd handle it with a statement like, "Yeah, I lost it to some broad I did it with just once. It was some girl I met down the shore." The "how'd you lose your virginity" conversation was always something of a touchy subject with me for a few reasons. The first being that, as far as I was concerned, it happened for me very late. It might not have been late in some communities, like the ones where kids are locked in cages until marriage, but compared to the average kid growing up in my town, there was no contest. I lost it pretty late. I had some friends who first did it when they were 13. Can you imagine how hard it was to be friends with these guys? In teenage boy terms, they had discovered pussy, the meaning of life, when they were in junior fucking high. I was still keeping a record of my wiffle ball batting average when suddenly my buddy Joey got laid and instantly he didn't care about all that stuff. I couldn't understand why, and I made fun of him for it. "Dude, I'm at 387, you're at 380, you gotta catch up," I said to him. And he just gave me a look that said, "Yeah, Art, I've actually stuck my hard cock into pussy, so you know what? I'm gonna concede the wiffle ball batting title to you. Enjoy those small victories, bro." He'd held in his hands the holy fucking grail of male adolescence. Wiffle ball paled in comparison. My lack of experience in that department was extra torturous for me, considering that I actually had a girlfriend in high school. Sue Picardi, the girl from the bank robbery. Sure, I got to second base, I did some heavy petting or whatever you want to call it, but I was as close to having actual sex with Sue as a 4-year one-on-one game of spin the bottle would have gotten me. Getting a girl's clothes all the way off was a pipe dream. I had this overly attentive Italian mother who'd shown me how to put my jacket and shirt on properly and how to fold it when I went on a trip. So technically, I'd have been better helping a girl put her clothes on than I was at getting them off. So here we go. It's time for me to come clean about this virginity thing, because I'm sick of carrying it around inside of me. For the first time ever, anywhere, to anyone who cares, I'm telling the truth and admitting that I didn't lose my virginity until about a week after my 19th birthday. Like I said, where I came from, that was late. Maybe not for people living in the 1930s and 1940s, but for teenagers living in the 80s, it was pretty fucking late, man. Forget about today, when it seems like every time you look in the paper, there's something new about kids having sex with teachers or kids getting caught having sex, doing things that most adults don't even do, all in like the 7th grade. Nowadays, they call a female teacher who forces a 7th grader to have sex with her a criminal. Back in the late 70s, we would have called her the coolest fucking teacher ever. If I had the same kind of success rate I had as a teen today, I can't even imagine how much of a loser I'd be. Add to that the fact that I lost my virginity to a full-blown Brazilian hooker, and you may get an idea why I have yet to break this heartwarming tale out at holiday cocktail parties. Say what you will about it, I don't care, because this girl was unbelievably fucking hot. She was in this country illegally, big surprise, and was 18 at the time, at least according to her. For the sake of many things, we're going to call her Mary, and predictably, I fell completely in love with her. She barely spoke English, and that could not have mattered less to me. I was devoted to her from the moment she made a man out of me. Right after my 18th birthday, a few months after graduating from high school, my father, as you know, fell from a roof. And my mom, sister, and I had to deal with all that came with him being permanently paralyzed. None of us knew which way was up for a while, and during that time, I forgot all about juvenile goals and pranks. But when I did resurface and resume life in the usual way to the extent I could, losing my virginity became an obsession. It was just something I had to do, and more than ever before, something I had to do right now. I'm sure it was that lesson life teaches you when you or a loved one experiences a tragedy. Do not take your time here for granted. If my dad could go from the most strapping motherfucker that ever was to someone who needed care 24/7 in the blink of an eye, it could happen at any time to anyone. It made me reassess my life goals, and having sex became the number one priority. It became clear to me that there was no way in hell that I was going to let myself die a virgin, nor was I willing to enter my 20s a virgin either. I had to lose my virginity while there was still an een at the end of my age. End of story. At the time, I had no prospects at all, but not for lack of trying. All of which did wonders for my self-esteem, by the way. Just shy of my 19th birthday, I really began to panic. I remember sitting one afternoon, methodically going over my options, taking into account the ever-shrinking time left. At that point, if the opportunity presented itself, I would have fucked Rue McClanahan. And that was the day I decided, fuck it. I'm doing this on time. I'm having sex with a woman, even if it has to be a hooker. For some reason, I figured that hookers were something I could figure out without any guidance, so if worse came to worst, I'd just find a whore on the street and end this virginity bullshit before my 20th birthday. Salvation came, ironically enough, through holy matrimony. My buddy Shecky's brother was getting married in November 1986, and he had his bachelor party on a night that is a legendary moment for New York baseball fans. It was held on October 11th at one of the shittier union halls in Elizabeth, New Jersey. I have no idea about the hierarchy among organizations like the Knights of Columbus and the Elks, but I can tell you that the union that owned the place where they threw Mike's party was much farther down the food chain. I can't imagine that they were even nationally recognized, because to be kind, this place was the recreation center that time forgot. Elizabeth, New Jersey is generally a nice working-class neighborhood, but a large part of it, the part that no one likes to talk about, is a real shitty ghetto, and that's exactly where this hall was. Clearly the best man, who like the groom was only about 25, had gotten his shit together late, because this room wouldn't be anybody's first choice. Like many of my life's more memorable experiences, the backdrop to this one was a history-making baseball game. The night the Mets beat the Red Sox and won Game 6 of the World Series. For those of you who know nothing about baseball, and I'm sorry for you, I'm talking about the infamous game where Mookie Wilson's grounder rolled through Bill Buckner's legs and the Mets won. That error changed the momentum of the series, and the Red Sox could not come back. The Mets took Game 6 and went on to win Game 7 the very next night. At the bachelor party, the game was a major focus of the evening because people there had bet on it, and quite a few of the partygoers were Mets fans as well. I was not one of them. I'm proud to say that from the moment I could first recognize a pinstripe, it was only the Yankees navy and white for me. The Mets and their stupid orange and cheap blue always were and still are such an abomination to me. I'm so anti-Mets that I was actually rooting for the Red Sox that night, and no one there could fathom that I, a diehard Yankee fan, could do such a thing. Whatever, those people are fucking idiots. The Red Sox might be the Yankees' archenemy, but it seemed so obvious to me that the fucking Mets team that year was worth hating much, much more. I mean, Lenny Dykstra, Keith Hernandez, and Darryl Strawberry. That whole fucking team was just a bunch of gung-ho cheerleader types. I couldn't stand those motherfuckers. Years later, when I found out they were all doing blow and getting into bar fights when they weren't playing ball, I felt like an idiot. If there's one thing I've always valued in baseball players, it's the ability to be a fucked-up badass and still put up the numbers. Now, I still think the Mets as a club fucking suck, but the late 80s team, I have to admit, was cool as hell. I was just too much of a dumb fuck to know that at the time. But that shouldn't be a surprise to anyone, especially me. The only guy I hated back then and still hate is Gary Carter, because it's clear that the guy has always been an uptight motherfucker. Never trust a catcher who never needs a shave. They're just not right. In any case, that night, in a shitty room in Elizabeth, New Jersey, about 40 guys stood around watching the series instead of celebrating Mike's brother's final night of single life. The party didn't look to be shaping up into anything much. It just felt like we went to a really crappy bar where the drinks were free to watch the game. Until the best man told all of us that four whores were coming down. Apparently they were going to do some kind of lesbian show with an encore of blowing guys or doing whatever else we could negotiate with them in what the best man called the back room. That got my attention, all right. It looked like I'd get out of my teen years with some degree of self-respect after all. A hooker was a sure thing, but I was nervous about it anyway. So the next time I needed a piss break, I went to check out this back room the guy had mentioned. I came out of the bathroom and looked down the hall. Nothing, not even a broom closet. I was a little drunk, so I figured I'd missed the door or the hallway to this place. But as I looked around, I slowly figured out the obvious. The back room was the John. Now that would have been fine if we were somewhere with a passable can full of high-end amenities, like a door that locked. But we were working with a back room that even the cheapest hooker would never call her boudoir by choice. There were a few stalls, a dingy trash can, and an atmosphere that reeked of the skeevy and grotesque. It was a clear indication of where the night was heading. This run-down, perfectly innocent catering hall was about to become a pit of vice. In addition to the whores, someone had arranged for a few really low-level gangsters to show up to run gambling tables. They hauled in blackjack and roulette setups, and a few people started playing craps in the corners. There was liquor, there was blow, there was weed, and there were a couple of big kegs. It was the most low-rent fake version of Vegas there ever was. The crowning glory was the pint-sized black-and-white TV at one end of the room that everyone crowded around. The game had become such a big deal that most of the guys couldn't care less about other distractions. I was one of them, until the whores showed up. There were four of them, and two of them were kind of cute and younger. Or maybe I should say youngish, like a medium-hot girl who likes to go out on the town with fat friends who make her look better. The other two hookers were such train wrecks that the better two looked fresh as spring daisies. One of the old ones wasn't just old, she was elderly, and she had a lot of miles on her. And the other one, I swear to God, looked exactly like Larry King. She was wrinkled and just monstrous, and her tits were hanging down below her knees. Of course, she was the one who came up to the best man and said in a classic smoke and whiskey-drenched voice, "We're gonna put on a lesbian show first, and then we will hang out with all of you individually." Guys, as a rule, are idiots. Simple, stupid idiots. We reacted as if we were at a friend's house, and his mother had asked us for some help with the chores. "Okay," the best man said, "what do you need for that? Do you need anything from me?" In response, the woman let loose a line that became an instant classic among my friends. She looked at him very intensely. You could tell she was seriously thinking about it. "Okay," she said in a really gross, sultry kind of croak. "Do you have any rope or bungee cord?" I wasn't sure I'd heard her correctly. Yeah, he said, "I think I do." She and the guy went out to his car and found some rope in his trunk. Then they pulled an old banquet table to one end of the room and she got naked. A few guys proceeded to tie her down, following her very specific instructions. "You," she said to one of the guys, "wrap that bungee cord around my wrist, twice. Good, now hook it to the table leg. Now you, tie my ankles to the table with the rope. Do it tighter." It all got disgusting real fast. First of all, the table was old, rotting wood and so nasty that all I could think about were splinters getting stuck up her wrinkled ass. Then, when she was spread eagle and strapped down, she announced in her wicked witch voice, "Any of you can do what you want to me. You can fist me, you can lick me, you can stick anything you want up my pussy and my ass. Anything, as long as it's not sharp." There were definitely options in that department, because she'd arrived with a few different dildos, Benoit balls to slip in her asshole, and butt plugs. And apparently, if none of that was satisfying, you could just shove your arm in there. Bachelor parties are a unique and often uncomfortable male bonding tradition, because they are where you find out once and for all who in your crew is a true pervert. My experience has been that it's usually the nerdiest, most laid-back, passive guys you know. This party was no different. There were a couple of really conservative-looking twerps there who became as happy as kids on Christmas as they got literally elbow deep in this broad's cunt. Those two led the charge into hell, because after them, people started taking pictures with their arms all the way up her, treating her like she was a photo op at a tourist destination. It was pretty awful. While that was going on, the other three girls tried desperately to lure the rest of us away from the ball game. They got topless and started shoving their tits in people's faces and rubbing up on everybody. It was a great role reversal. Their power as chicks had been stripped away, since all of us preferred to watch baseball on a shitty small black-and-white TV than pay them any attention at all. It was more than just a game, though. It was turning out to be one of the best World Series games of all time. So it didn't help them any that none of the girls were what I'd call a young Carmen Electra. I remember every detail of that game, and it went like this. The Mets were down by 2 runs and down to their last out. Gary Jerkoff Carter got a hit. Then Kevin Mitchell got a hit. Now it's first and second. Ray Knight then got a single, scoring Gary Carter from second, moving Kevin Mitchell to third. With runners on first and third, Bob Stanley threw a wild pitch. Ray Knight moved to second. Kevin Mitchell scored, tying the game. After that, Mookie Wilson's hit rolled through Buckner's legs, sending a run home and winning it for the Mets. Ray Knight easily scored from second base when the ball went through Buckner's legs. Stanley's wild pitch was the error that won it for the Mets. I don't give a fuck what anybody says. It wasn't Buckner letting the ball roll through his legs. It was Bob Stanley's wild pitch. That was the big error. That made the game tied. The Mets had the momentum, and it would have went into extra innings at Shea Stadium. And besides, Wilson might have beaten out the throw anyway. In any case, the Mets won, and everybody went fucking crazy. Every guy in that room started yelling, either in anger or from joy, depending on how they'd bet that night. We kept on like that for a good 10 or 20 minutes afterward, in spite of the fact that there were tits being shoved in our faces on all sides. Aside from a few pervs with their hands up the old broad, no one could have cared less about anything but the game. Then that wore off, and everyone started to branch off and involve themselves in whatever vice, gambling, drugs, hookers, all of them, they preferred. I played blackjack and a little craps, the whole time trying to plot how I was going to make my transaction occur. I didn't put my fist or anything else in that woman on the table, though I definitely marveled at that freak show like it was an exhibit in a museum. While I was gawking, one of the two cuter chicks, the one who looked Hispanic, came up to me topless and in that hot accent said to me, "You want a blowjob?" I didn't even need to think about it. "Yeah," I said, "let's do this." She told me to go to the bathroom and wait in a stall, which I was not happy about. But I'd gotten a blowjob like that before, so it wasn't unfamiliar. The familiar ended when she put a rubber on me before she began to blow me. When I saw the rubber, I didn't think there was any way this was going to work. But it did. I was pretty pent up. Plus, even though she wasn't some great beauty, I found the girl kind of sexy. Most of all, she was just really good at her job. In about 15 seconds, I came, because let me tell you, she was that fantastic. But the best part was the price. $5. A really good blowjob for $5? That is a bargain. When she came in to do it, she was nude, except for her thong. And when I gave her the money, I wondered where she was going to put it. Before she started in, she took off one of her 5-inch heels and dropped it in there with about 20 other crumpled $5 bills. I'm not going to say that there were a bunch of horny fucks at this party, but when the girl left, she was about 6'7". The sad truth is that $5 is probably half of what I had on me. If I had had more, I would have definitely gotten another blowjob. I wasn't going to let that kind of talent at that price get away. I decided that I'd at least find out how much she charged me to take my virginity. I walked up to her when nobody was nearby and asked her very politely, how much would it be like to bang you? That would be $50, she said. You want to do it? I didn't have overly sentimental expectations for my first time, but attempting it in the lovely rear lounge at this place was too much. So I asked for her phone number in the same way you might ask for it from a guy who had a landscaping or a driveway paving business. "Listen," I said, "I might be able to use your services. I'd like to call you next week." I got her number, and it turned out that she lived in Elizabeth, over by the Camelot Diner on Morris Avenue, close to the border of Union, and less than a mile from my family's house. "That works out great," I told her, still acting like I'd be calling to get an estimate for the deck I planned to add to my house. It took me a couple of days to get up the nerve, but when I eventually called her, she said that she wasn't going to be around that night. I knew deep down that my courage wouldn't last, so I didn't want to make a plan with her for a few days down the line. I had free use of my father's handicap van that night, and since it had a ton of room in the back, I figured that tonight was the night. I'd throw a bunch of sleeping bags and some pillows back there to avoid paying for the hotel room that I could not afford. "I can't tonight," she said, "but my sister Mary is here, who is younger than me. She's 18, and she's very, very beautiful." "Oh, yeah?" "Yes, you could come talk to her," she said. "I bet that you will like her." It was taking a risk because I had no idea what her sister looked like, but I figured that a whore's concept of beautiful was probably different from mine. But being cautious wasn't really on my mind now that victory was within reach. Being a virgin was killing me. "Fuck it," I said. "Tell her I'm coming over." To me, there was no way I could be disappointed, considering what I imagined she'd look like. I fully expected to have sex with someone who looked like Louis Guzman. I drove the van over to their apartment complex. I buzzed up and she came down, and I was immediately in disbelief. This girl was beautiful. She looked kind of like Eva Longoria, that type of hot. She said she was 18, and I wasn't about to bounce her if she wasn't carrying ID. I could tell she was no child, so there was nothing sinister going on. And how much older was I at 19 anyway? I think I might have actually drooled watching her walk to the van, and she could tell. My eyes were lit up like Times Square. "You like me, right?" she said. "Yeah." I nearly shouted. I was so excited. "How much would you charge me to have, you know, full sex?" "This is $50, she said. "You want sex and blowjob? It's $75. "Fine," I said. "I brought cash with me. I have it right here." I didn't care for 1 minute that $75 was easily half of my net worth in life, probably more. And the virginity thing was still a concern, but her beauty transcended my mission. I just had to fuck this girl. She was that hot. The only conceivable problem was whether or not she'd do it in the handicap van. "We don't have to go anywhere, you know," I said, trying to make the back of my dad's van sound like a 4-star hotel. "We can do it right here and back. It's very comfortable." The language barrier was a problem because, unlike her sister, Mary barely spoke English. She looked at me, looked in the back, and then just looked hesitant. I gestured to the low-budget bed made of sleeping bags that I'd put together. "We will stay right in here," I said, louder and slower, like idiots do when they talk to foreign people. And then I tried to reassure her, "Don't be nervous. Everything will be okay." At this point, I was praying to God that Telemundo had never aired Silence of the Lambs. "I will not drive to any remote place where I could kill you or anything. We could park at maybe the diner, the Camelot Diner down the road," I pointed. "Camelo," she said. "Okay, Camelo." "I fuck you in van," I said. "Is okay? I bang you in truck?" "No one around at Camelot. I fuck you in truck, okay?" "Okay," she said. "Fucking truck, Camelo." Let me tell you, arranging for paid sex is both more humiliating and ultimately more rewarding when you have to think, speak, and hand gesture your intentions as slowly as if you're a retard. You really feel like you've earned something when you finally get it. As a matter of fact, there would be fewer misunderstandings in marriage if negotiations like that took place right at the altar. The priest could take care of it. Just before the vows, he could say something like, "Miss, do you understand that you are offering to blow and fuck him for a period of at least 1 year?" "Yes." "Sir, do you understand that she's offering to blow and fuck you for a period of 1 year, and it will cost you a house in the suburbs, a minivan, and a Honda Civic?" "Yes." "Do you also understand that in exchange for her blowing and fucking you, you must agree to work non-stop and listen to her bitch every 5 seconds?" "Yes." "Do you also understand that after a period of 1 year, further blowing and fucking will cost you one necklace per year?" "Yes." "And do you also understand that over the next several years you are required to give her 2 or 3 children that will cost you $100,000 a child?" "Yes." "And you also understand that after a period of several years, the fucking and sucking will cease, but this arrangement will still cost you 80% of your worth?" "I do. You may kiss the bride." It's depressing, yes, but God knows it's the fucking truth. Anyway, when we arrived at the Camelot Diner, which is still there, by the way, but it's now called the Tropicana, I found an appropriately quiet spot in the back by the dumpster. This wasn't some big parking lot. People were definitely going to be driving by pretty close to us, but no one was going to think anyone was in the van, so it would probably be okay. There were homes right there, too, because Elizabeth is basically the inner city, so if someone looked out of their window at the right angle, they might see something. I didn't care. I locked the doors, and then I figured I'd better be straight with her. Me, I said, pointing at myself, first time. Huh, she said? First time, I said. Now first time. I then used the universal sign for banging, which is putting your finger through a hole you make with the index finger and thumb on your other hand. She smiled at me, just coy and adorable. Lo sé, she said. I know this. Really, I said. You know. How? Lo sé. I was nervous as hell. I'd been obsessed with getting to this point and getting laid, not even by a girl as hot, and now all I could do was stall. I tried my best to make small talk, as if she actually understood or cared about one word I was saying. Like her sister, Mary was really good at what she did for a living, because after a few minutes she ignored me altogether and just handled the situation. Dinero, she said, what you want? I would like the deluxe, please, I said like an idiot. The intercourse with the blowjob on the side. The what, she said? I don't know if I said it because I'd seen it in some shitty teen sex movie, or just because we were at a diner where my favorite meal was a cheeseburger deluxe. In any event, she took the money and counted it, and that seemed to get the message across. You want fuck and blowjob? Yes, I do, I said. In hindsight, I should have asked her for some French fries, too, and really tried to confuse the foreign cunt. So, you like New Jersey? After another painful minute or two of trying to make conversation, this girl just leaned over and started kissing me on the lips, which unbeknownst to me was a real treat. As I got older and more experienced with whores, I learned that kissing was not something they did regularly. It was too intimate. Of course, anyone who saw a pretty woman could tell you that, too. That's about the only realistic detail in that film, as far as L.A. street hookers go. If you don't believe me, ask Hugh Graham. At 19, I was thin, and I wasn't bad-looking. I'd probably have had a shot at Mary since I wasn't yet grotesque, as I am now. I swear to Christ, when I was younger, I really was kind of a good-looking guy. Then one day in the mid-90s, I woke up, and I'd become Vic Tayback. The honest truth is, I thought she was attracted to me. I thought this was like the best date I'd ever had, and maybe the start of a relationship. You tend to lose your ability to reason clearly when an incredibly hot woman puts the moves on you, whether you're paying her or not. But I realized that her attraction to me might not be all that strong when I noticed that she'd stopped kissing me until, much like her sister, I put the $75 in her shoe. I swear to God, I should have paid these broads extra to fuck me with no shoes on just to see where they'd put the money. Once business was settled, we moved into the rear lounge. We sprawled out on the luxurious sleeping bags, and she took out a rubber. She put it on me with her mouth, which a lot of whores have done to me since. That's such a skill. I suggest that whores everywhere make it a permanent part of their routine. Whores who know how to do it right, please teach your friend whores. We started rolling around. Her long jet black hair was loose. She got naked, and then I got on top of her. And because I was a complete and utter novice, it took me a little while to find the proper hole. I didn't need a guide in, though. I did get it on my own. And once I was in there, I've got to tell you, I lasted probably a good minute and a half, which is way longer than a lot of other people have told me they lasted when they lost their virginity. I can be straight about this. My manly staying power wasn't due to my ironclad concentration or some kind of tantric sex self-hypnosis I learned about from Sting. It was strictly the awkwardness of the situation, because I was preoccupied with the fact that we were fucking in my father's handicapped van. I can clearly remember my schizophrenic train of thought as I was banging her. It seesawed between, I can't believe I'm fucking a chick this hot, and Jesus, look at those tits, to, I'd better not leave any stains back here, and is tomorrow when I have to drive Pop to the rehabilitation center? I was somehow in the situation and watching it from a distance at the same time. I was happy to be having sex, but where I was doing it was at once funny and unbelievably depressing. I never shared this story with my father before he died, and sometimes when I recall it, I think I should have, because he probably would have found it hilarious. Let me tell you, once I was finished banging Mary, that same delusion that hit when she started kissing me returned, twice as bad. I suddenly felt such a connection to this girl that if I thought she understood more than every third word I said, I'd have told her all of my hopes and dreams and asked her to be my wife. Instead, we sat in silence for a while and sort of cuddled. It was the most intimate moment I'd ever shared with a woman. Then she started giving me kind of a hand job, which got me hard again. Then she blew me without a rubber on. I now know that no matter what you're paying, this is very, very rare for a hooker. In my mind, at that moment, she was no longer a hooker. She was a girl who clearly liked me. She was really into it, I thought. She was probably acting, but it sounded to me like I might have even satisfied her on some level. I was so happy with the way my first time went. It was a milestone, like the first time I was asked to appear on Letterman or when I played Carnegie Hall. I felt such an instant bond to this girl that I considered offering to help her study for her SATs. I'm sure someone of her background would have been impressed with my combined score of 860. "Look," I said to her, "is it okay if we do this again?" "See," she said, "see, is okay, I like you." Then she gave me a kiss on the cheek. That did nothing to help me stay focused on the reality of the situation. After I dropped her off, I went straight back to the Camelot Diner and ordered a bacon, egg, and cheese on a hard roll with large chocolate milk. I have eaten that delicious, nutritious meal many times since, but it never came close to tasting as good as it did then. This was back when people were civilized and you were allowed to smoke inside, so afterward I lit up a cigarette. God, was that fantastic. As my friend Dan the Song Parody Man says, a cigarette after dinner is one of the 40 best cigarettes of the day. About a week later, I called Mary again. I had somehow gotten together the necessary 75 bucks, and the same exact scenario happened once again, including my meal afterward at the Camelot. And that wasn't the last time either, because she and I had a thing going. It was more drawn out each time we got together. We spent more time talking, and I got to know her a little. She told me that she and her sister were in the country illegally, which gave her an edge that I found incredibly sexy. There was no doubt about it. I was really smitten. I just thought she was a doll. She was adorable, and I liked her personality. So I tried to talk to her about how we could get her a green card to stay in the country. I didn't care if I had to keep paying her for our dates. I wanted this girl to be my girlfriend. My friends might take some work, but I figured I could easily bullshit my mom about it. There's no rule that you have to tell your mother that your girlfriend is a whore. Besides, this chick was young. She didn't look haggard. She didn't look like she'd done the rope and bungee cord bit at bachelor parties yet, that's for sure. I started thinking of how our relationship could develop, which was completely crazy. I concluded that the best thing to do was just dive in. I seriously considered just asking her to marry me. Mary and I did it a total of 4 times. The last time we got together, I actually sprung for a room. It wasn't much of a departure from the van. In fact, in some ways, it was worse. It was a shitty small motel called the Garden State Motor Lodge that is still there on Route 22 eastbound in Union, a couple of miles before you hit Freeland Eisen Avenue in Newark. That was where some of the more happening kids in high school took broads to get laid. I was really into this girl, so I splurged. I went for one of their top-tier $18-a-night rooms. This place was one of those establishments where rooms were also available by the hour. I'm pretty sure that's the deal I went for. It paid off, too. My girl gave me the usual, plus a free blowjob. The time before, she also didn't charge me for the blowjob, which was wonderful. It was the kind of treatment that convinced me that we should definitely get married. I mean, how many guys' girlfriends don't charge them for a blowjob on their 4th date? Think about how much it costs just getting to the 4th date. The day after our rendezvous at the Garden State Motor Lodge, I was on cloud 9 and decided to proceed with my plan to introduce her to my family, which was my first step at making this a real, eventually non-payment-based relationship. I was unsure about it, though, because of the profound sadness in our house. My mom was a tower of strength. She was the only thing keeping us all together, and I thought that bringing an attractive girl over so I could tell my mom I had a girlfriend might improve her mood. I've never asked my sister, but I'm pretty sure she didn't lose her virginity to a male whore. She probably went a more conventional route. Oh, wait, my sister, as well as every other girl I'm related to, has never had sex. I've never done anything normally in my entire life, really. I'm a fucked-up person, let's face it. Quite frankly, I'm lucky to have any sort of job at all, much less a job working on the coolest radio show ever and making the kind of money I make today. Back then, I already knew that I was fucked up, and I knew that losing my virginity the way I did was fucked up. But I thought that I could turn it around. Even though I wasn't going to school like my sister, I'd at least show my mom that I'd met a nice girl and might have a shot at getting married and having some kind of normal life. Of course, this story has a sad ending, like most fucking things in my life do, particularly when women are involved. About a week later, I called Mary's apartment, and her sister told me that Mary had gone back to Brazil. My heart dropped. I swallowed hard and almost couldn't speak. Really? I said. What happened? Well, she has a boyfriend back there, her sister said. He was going to come over here, and then he does not. He knows nothing about what we are doing here, okay? That's really too bad, I said. The sister spoke English pretty well compared to Mary, so she was able to explain their situation. She's not coming back, she said. We are really nice people. We are very religious. We are doing this only to make money so we could get over here, and her boyfriend wants her to go back. But she said you are very nice, and if you want to come by, I will be happy to help you out. Now that's my kind of religious chick. Yeah, maybe we could do that, I said, knowing full well that I had no intention of it. I'll call you. I didn't want to flat-out turn her down, but as far as I was concerned, she wasn't even in Mary's league. I remember hoping that things would get better for Mary in her village. But to be honest, it sounded like the best career a woman could land back there was becoming a heroin mule. And now, years later, after all of my struggles with drugs, I'd like to think that possibly I've done some heroin that Sweet Mary shit out at a Best Western in the South Bronx, perhaps at gunpoint. It might sound strange to you, but I guess I'm just a hopeless romantic. I was instantly depressed because those dates with Mary were just about all I had to live for. I ended up calling her sister back the next day. I told her to have Mary call me if she ever returned to the States and gave her my phone number. At that point, I had my own phone line in our house, which rang only in my room. I kept that number for another 10 years and never got a call. It took me a while to get over Mary, and as you can tell, I'll never forget her. More than a few times in the months and years to follow, I'd drive by her apartment complex. I kept thinking each time I passed by that I'd see her back in town, just walking down the street, heading home. In the back of my mind, I never totally believed her sister's story. I thought maybe I'd creeped her out somehow, or that she could see I was getting attached and had her sister make up a story. My self-esteem is always good in a pinch. Nothing can change the fact that I had 4 wonderful meetings with this girl, and she helped me become a man. And she did it while there was still an een at the end of my age. Thank the Lord for that. Besides, I guarantee that none of my friends lost their virginity to a chick hotter than Mary. She had a nice ass, and she had beautiful thighs. She had real tits that were a solid C-cup, young and perky. She was built just exactly the way I like a chick to be built. In the years to come, one of my favorite bars became a place called McGee's, which later became Suspenders. That isn't far from the Camelot Diner. I spent far too many nights there in my 20s, drinking and getting arrested for drunk and disorderly, for fighting, and also for a DUI. On the nights when no one ended up in jail, my buddies Chico, Shecky, Deej, and I would usually end up at the Camelot eating cheeseburger deluxes, chocolate milks, cheesecakes, and chocolate layer cake well into the night. I never said anything to them, but I was usually sitting there wishing Mary would walk in. In my drunker moments, I'd daydream it. She'd stroll through the door, looking every inch as hot as she was. We'd go out into the parking lot, and then I'd say to her, much like Abe Vigoda said to Robert Duvall in The Godfather, "Mary, could you throw me one for old time's sake?" And much like Duvall said to him, she'd say, "Can't do it, Artie." Well, that never happened. Instead, I spent many of those nights fending off questions from my friends about how I lost my virginity. I was always so vague that I'm not sure even I remember the bullshit story I used. I think it went something like this. So yeah, it was the summer of 85 and I was down the shore one weekend. This chick was a friend of a friend. I can't even remember what high school she went to. But it was just that one weekend and then she never called me. Yeah, that sounds about right. I was so embarrassed about the story, even 10 years later, that I still couldn't admit it. It's not like my friends hadn't done dumb shit. I certainly could have told my buddy Deej. He's the only other guy who went to my high school and wanted to get into show business. We got real tight in our late teens and 20s by walking that road together. We went on auditions and took acting classes in Greenwich Village for the few weeks we could afford to. We had a bond, because to do that at all, we had to be able to embarrass ourselves in front of each other all the time. Deej is a great guy. He would have understood, but for some reason, I could never get up the balls to share it. Even though for years, I was dying to tell someone this story. As for my squiring skills, after Mary, I went into a big drought. I thought that all I needed to do was lose my virginity and then I'd just be having sex all the time, forever. I figured that once I'd done it, I'd have some kind of natural sex knowledge that broads would sense. I wouldn't act any different, but I'd have an invisible manly swagger as a non-virgin that would make me irresistible. I think it's what's affectionately known as having stank on your down low. That didn't happen, but about a year later, I went on a ski trip against my will. Skiing just ain't my thing. Let me put it to you this way. For years, my manager tried to get me to do the Aspen Comedy Festival, and I told him that the two groups of people I hate most in this world are comedians and people who ski. So it sounded like a living hell. I do not ski, nor will I ever. But this one time I got talked into it by my buddy Al, his girlfriend Toby, and Deej, just as a way to get the fuck out of town. We drove up to a place called Owl's Nest in Ontario, Canada, where I spent my time drinking in the lodge. And that's where I met the second girl I ever had sex with. I got her drunk one night on absolute vodka, and I made Deej spend the night in Al and Toby's room. I won't name names, but my buddies definitely remember her, because that story has never really gone out of rotation. Mostly because on the drive home, we were trying to figure out who the girl looked like. An hour into it, I had it. She looked exactly like Elton John. To this day, if anything about Canada or skiing is mentioned, one of my friends will start singing, "It's a little bit funny, this feeling inside." There was one remarkable thing about that experience. The girl was a virgin. She was the only virgin I've ever slept with. I do see something humorous in the fact that my virginity was taken by a complete pro, and the next time I had sex, I played that role, just not nearly as well. As far as my sexual history goes, I didn't start putting up any real numbers until I began going into New York City to try my luck doing stand-up. Once I was involved in the New York scene and doing coke and hitting after-hours clubs, it became much easier. Anyone who was or is involved in that scene knows it's a no-brainer. You meet broads and you have cocaine relationships, which revolve around doing lots of cocaine and then fucking. Those are never a sure thing, however, because usually girls who want to hang with you for coke love coke way more than they love fucking. In my struggling years in New York, I probably put up another 7 or 8 broads, which for me are strong numbers because I have never been a ladies' man. However bold I may be when I'm on stage or making a fool of myself for laughs, it goes right out the window in the presence of a beautiful woman. And time and success have done nothing at all to change that. I'm still unbelievably shy around women. It's the classic scenario. As a performer, I'm more comfortable on stage in front of 5,000 people than one-on-one with a hot chick. When I got my role on Mad TV in the summer of 1995, I was 27 years old. My number at that point was 11. Only 2 of them were repeat customers, 3 of them if you include Mary the hooker. I had only 3 repeats. I would like to have said 3-peats, but I didn't want to have to pay Pat Riley a licensing fee. But by that point, I'd been to a lot of bachelor parties, so I'd been blown by about 50 different women. I'm sure many of my fans will be disappointed to hear that of the 11 I had sex with, only 2 were whores, which makes that 9 regular chicks I was able to talk into bed. I did find out when I moved to L.A., however, that if you're a regular on a network show, you can be the world's biggest retard and still get laid. And that's a good thing for me, for obvious reasons. Still, my numbers should be much better. At the age of 40, 13 years into show business, I have somehow moved up the ladder into the major leagues of entertainment, but my numbers haven't really jumped accordingly. I went from doing stand-up to a network show, to having a network deal, to being in studio movies, and then to a regular spot on the biggest radio show ever. When we talked about numbers again recently on the air, I was vague about it, because for the first time in my life, I actually couldn't remember. I secretly felt so cool that I had actually lost count of how many chicks I banged. I tried my best to add it all up tonight, and I'd say I'm up to around 80. If I'd never gotten into show business, of course, I'd probably still be lingering down around 11. But now that I'm thinking about it, 80 is a really low number considering the career I've had. I've spent the last 7 years doing the Howard Stern Show, and that is the ultimate, the best regular gig a comedian can have. Doing Howard, plus all the stand-up I do, I've seen every kind of groupie, because a headlining comedian in a good club can get sex, drugs, anything. I figure that a guy who was at all good with women and had my same career for the past 13 years would be up over 1,000, while 80 might be a lot for a normal guy. Remember that we're talking about 80 put up by a guy who in his 40s still sucks with women, and is in a line of work where it's easy to get broads. It's much more realistically pathetic when you see it that way, don't you think? Ladies and gentlemen out there in Bookland, this is Artie Lang, and I'd like to talk to you about that certain time that comes up in every professional's life, especially an entertainer. that time that we've all had to face in our careers. And of course, I'm talking about the time to simply give up. I was trying to read this entire book, and I couldn't do it because of what I told the people here was sweat from being sick. It was clearly withdrawals from heroin. I was sweating to death and ruining the headsets and John Marshall sound, and I was afraid of spreading some sort of crazy disease. And instead of cleaning up and finishing the rest of the book, I did what I've done so many times before in my life. I simply gave up. I am the direct opposite of what Derek Jeter would want from a kid. Will Smith always says, don't let anybody ever tell you you can't do something. Never give up. Well, I don't think that's realistic. I was told by my family to give up, and I did. And if they didn't tell me that, I'd still be trying to play shortstop for the Yankees, and it would be weird, quite frankly. I'd be down in Tampa like this 40-year-old drunk guy with a uniform on that he bought at Target, trying to get in batting practice and play shortstop. But instead, my family, being realistic and a good family, said, listen, you'll never play shortstop for the Yankees. This is ridiculous. You're heavy set. You're not that coordinated. You're sort of stupid. You will never play for the Yankees. Give up. Do something else. You have to give up. You're an idiot, and you're embarrassing us. And that was good advice. I think they could have waited till after my 9th birthday, but I think that was good advice. So with this audiobook, 6 chapters in, as you'll see, I gave up, and I called other people to finish it for me. And I paid them way, way low figures as far as the book world is concerned. I ripped off my friends. And they finished the book for me because I'm a unrecovering drug addict. I chose the only 3 people that I could think of to finish a book. Jimmy Florentine, an inarticulate Jersey comic with a annoying voice. Gary Delabate, a man who I love, but whose teeth gets in the way of everything he says. And my other friend who can't read. Enjoy myself, Jim Florentine, Gary Bababui Delabate, and the Reverend Bob Levy, the only Jewish guy who cannot read, and we'll read this book to you, okay? I'm just explaining why I'm not reading the whole thing, and my fans are used to me giving up, and what can I tell you? See you on the road at some shitty hotel. Bye.
Too Fat to Fish, My Days as a Longshoreman. I grew up with about 52 guys named Mike, so pretty early on, each of them was given a nickname to tell them all apart. Checky, Joker, Deeg, Dutt, and Goof, to name a few. Of all those illustrious nicknamed Mikes, Goof plays a major role in this story. At the time of my father's death, I was 22 years old, unemployed, and I owed bookies and Shylocks money. I was a drunk who started doing drugs a little too much and gambled with money I didn't have. All I hope is that there's an afterlife, so my father could see that the son who was such a fuck-up when he died went on to make something of himself. But at the time of this story, that was a long way off. By 1990, a bunch of my friends had gone through college and were ready to graduate. I'd done nothing for those 4 years except try stand-up twice with miserable results and take one acting class in Greenwich Village with my buddy. I couldn't stay enrolled in it for very long because I didn't have enough money, so all I'd really done was get a 4-year degree in vegetating. While Pop was alive, time stood still for us, but once he was gone, it was like I woke up and realized that the world had been passing me by. His death lit a fire under my ass, so about a month after he died, I saw an ad in the paper and went to a club in Greenwich Village that was having a stand-up comedy contest sponsored by a radio station on Long Island. I was one of 10 contestants, and it was officially the 3rd time I ever did stand-up. 3 years had gone by since I last tried it, and I'd done so badly that it took me that long to forget it. But I just said, fuck it, for my father I'll try it again. I came in 6th place, which wasn't great, but at least there were 4 people in the world shittier at it than I was. It was incentive enough to try it again. I also decided to get myself a job of some kind, and Goof was there for me. He asked his father to give me a job in the machine shop he owned in Roselle, New Jersey. The only opening I could fill was sweeping up, doing basic machine work, drilling stuff, working on a lift, and loading and unloading this powder that is used to sandblast stuff on major industrial construction jobs. Goof's dad had a side business where he would buy all the sandblasting powder in bulk then package it up in huge buckets and secure it to pallets that were sold and loaded onto trucks. Part of my job was sweeping up around that operation. I started 2 days after my father's memorial mass and got $6 an hour under the table. That sparked exactly 1 year of absolute nothingness. Just a shit-awful loser bullshit year in my life. I worked at that job for $6 an hour, and I could get there whatever time I wanted as long as I finished all the work I had for the day. Here's how my typical workday went. I would get there at noon, do my work, and be finished by about 7 or 8 o'clock at night. A lot of nights, Goof would come over from the machine area and help me finish up so we could get out of there quicker and start our night of drinking. For dinner, we'd order a bacon pizza from Domino's and bring it back to the area where all the sand was stored. I will never forget all the bacon pizzas we consumed that year because each and every one ended up being coated in that disgusting sand, which seemed to settle evenly over the top of the bacon and cheese the second we'd open the box. God knows what was in that shit, because it actually changed the color of the pizza from a healthy white and red to this toxic shade of magenta. I've never seen that color anywhere else in the natural world. Between that, the 8-packs of Marlboro Reds I was smoking a day, and the old Granddad or Jim Beam I bring to work to get loaded, I probably took 10 years off my life in that 1 year alone. On a good week, I'd make probably about $250, cash, almost all of which I spent at local bars around the Union area. One of them was this place where the bartender would give us free drinks all night. He started serving us when we were like 15, and he just didn't care. He was running a racket and a half in there. Every single buddy of his who came in drank for free, and he pocketed all the tips directly. The bar was always crowded, but the owner couldn't figure out why he was barely breaking even. A real whiz with numbers, that guy. We'd also go to the sports bar and drink ourselves into oblivion. We'd do blow whenever it was around, and I'd gamble with money that I didn't have. I did have the distinction, however, of being the first one of my friends to put in a 100-timer gambling. The smallest bet a bookie takes is called a time. That is not to be confused with a dime, which is a bet for $1,000. 50 dimes and 50 times are very different things. Dimes are for high rollers, and times are for people who are not high rollers, like me and my friends. In our world, though, if you bet 20 times, you were a high roller, because that's a $100 bet. $100 to us was a hell of a lot to put on the line. There was also a VIG you had to pay the bookie if you lost, which was a $1 charge per $5 time. So if you lost $100, you really lost $110. A VIG is like a tax for losing that basically gives the bookie and the Shylock an advantage, meaning they will probably always be in the money, even if more people win than lose that week. VIGs only counted on bets of $50 or more at a rate of $5 per 50 lost. Everyone knew that if you bet less than $50, you were a fucking pussy anyway, and they felt too sorry for your loser ass to charge you a VIG. During this period, my buddies and I got a number for a bookie on Staten Island whose name was Bobo, and we bet on and off with him for like 8 years until one day he just disappeared. The number didn't work and no one knew what happened. But before Bobo fell off the face of the earth, I became the first of my friends to bet a 100-timer, and I bet it with Bobo. It was a 10-buck VIG for every 100 bucks you bet, so a 100-timer would be betting $500. If I lost, I'd owe $550. And if I won, I'd win $500. None of my friends had come anywhere close to that. Considering that I had about $80 to my name, they couldn't believe what I was doing. Bobo took the bet, which I had to place through a couple of our friends, who acted as middlemen for all the bets we placed. Bobo would send a guy down from Staten Island to take the bets and collect or pay out each week, and they'd meet him at the McDonald's parking lot on the parkway in Union. Our friends never actually met Bobo. No one we knew had ever seen him. They only dealt with Bobo's guy. The game I bet on was the Giants versus the 49ers in about week 10 of the season on Monday Night Football. Obviously, I thought I had a sure win on my hands, but this was both the year that my judgment was about as clear as my vision after a bottle of Jack Daniels, and the season when the Giants overachieved and beat the 49ers in the NFC Championship before beating the Bills in the Super Bowl. Bobo's line on this regular season Monday Night game was the 49ers giving 3.5 points to the Giants. Now, some lines had them giving 4, and the New York Post and the Daily News had them giving 4.5, but Bobo's line was 3.5. I've always liked the Giants, and they were playing out in San Francisco, so I said, fuck it. The Giants will definitely cover 3.5 points. To anyone who doesn't know what I'm talking about, it meant that if the Giants won outright, and you bet the Giants, you won. And if they lost, but only by 3 points, you won dough too, since the points given was 3.5. If they lost by more than 3.5 points, then you lost your money, and you paid the VIG. All the Giants had to do was not lose by more than 3.5 points for me to collect. We watched the game at a bar, and in a shining example of my shitty luck that year, it turned out to be a grueling defensive battle that the Giants lost 7-3. And you know what? I blame Joe Montana. That motherfucker is responsible for me losing more fucking money in my life, that fucking asswipe. I cannot stand watching him interviewed, even today. Fuck him. So anyway, I lost $550 and I had only $80, and what unfolded next has become a classic story among my friends. I was in that state of mind that people who have been on the skids know well. It's when you just don't give a fuck at all and you handle situations that you should be taking more seriously as if they're a joke because you really don't care what happens to you. When you feel that way, you're actually hoping for something or someone to make a decision for you because you don't give a shit about doing anything for yourself. My nonchalance worried my friend who had to meet Bobo's guy. "Artie, what the fuck am I going to tell this guy?" he said. "Tell him I don't have the money. It's not like you'll be lying," I said. "Are you serious?" "Yeah. Can't I work it off or something?" I was acting like Bobo had a restaurant and I could just do dishes for a few weeks to cover my dinner tab. It wasn't too far from the truth in the end. The middleman who represented Bobo each week actually had a roofing business, and when he met my friend, he came up with a solution. "Yeah, tell your dumb fuck friend Artie that I'm working 2 6-day weeks up at this place in Clifton," he said. "I'll give that jerk off $250 each week and he can work it off." I accepted and spent 2 weeks roofing with this fucking guy up in Clifton in really shitty late fall weather. It was glamorous work, climbing my ass up and down a ladder on a roof with a steep pitch, carrying these enormous fucking bags of shingles. 6 days each week, I worked a 14-hour day. I was expecting $250 a week, so I'd be even after 2 weeks. But when I shook his hand that last day, he told me otherwise. "Well, thanks, man. I really appreciate it," I said. "We're even, right?" "Even," he said. "The fuck are you talking about, jerkoff? You still owe Bobo the $50 vig." That was the kind of prick I was dealing with. I don't know who I borrowed it from, but I came up with the $50 vig, and then I was even. And then, in one of my rare rational decisions from that period, I actually stopped gambling for a while. I think I made it through to the playoffs before trying my hand again. In the meantime, I lived vicariously through a few of my friends who tried to get one over on Bobo by betting on hockey games. These geniuses figured out that the NHL held one day game a week, on Wednesday afternoons, while every other game in the season was played at night. Bobo didn't pay much attention to hockey, so one time, for a goof, they bet with his middleman on a game that had already happened. With Bobo, you had to call all of your bets in by 7 p.m. So they watched the game that afternoon and bet on the winner because it was an outside shot that Bobo would think the game was on for Wednesday night. Sure enough, Bobo looked at the scores the next day, not knowing about the day game thing, saw that they'd won, and he paid him out. That was it. They were in on a sure thing. As long as they didn't arouse suspicion, they could probably keep it going for a while. But that wasn't enough for these guys. They wanted to win big.